Gavin Woods Podcast, proudly brought to you by Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Hi there, this is James Ryan, and you're listening to Gavin Woods Podcast.
My special guest on the podcast is James Michael Nugent Rain, OAM, commonly known to his mates as James Rain. Hi, James.
Hi, Gavin. How are you?
Good. Hey, it's a pleasure to talk to you. We've got a lot to cover. You've got an amazing body of work.
Well, thank you very much. I guess if you hang around long enough, you amass stuff.
You've been very busy. I mean, rock musician, singer, songwriter, and back in the 80s, lead singer, of course, with the iconic Australian Crawl. How big was that band back in the 80s? You guys must have had so much fun in your early formative years.
We certainly had fun in the early formative years. I mean, we had fun all the way through. Towards the end, it got a bit, That's why it finished, I think. But, it was great fun. It was great fun. But also, we all learnt a lot. Because you realise that to keep something like that going, you have to start. I think we'd been in a couple of not very good bands, before that, that they didn't last very long and they weren't very good. But we did learn things like you have to run it as a sort of a business. You've got to, if you make any money, you've got to put it back in the band, things like that. We learned some valuable lessons all the way through.
Thank goodness. A band that can see the future and not just tomorrow.
Yeah, well, I think that was the other thing too. We never really had a master plan. We were just kind of existing day to day, but we realised to keep the thing running, you've got to run it somewhat as a business.
Yeah, great days. And look, we're going to get to your upcoming solo tour soon in this podcast. The solo, you start a great solo tour around Australia in October, November.
Yep.
And all the dates are on jamesrain.com.au.
That's right.
And the brilliant thing is you can get your tickets from there as well. That's like a one-stop shop. I like that.
Yeah, it is. It's good. It's one of the great things about the internet.
Yes. Thank goodness. Hey, mate, let's go back. Where were you born?
I was born in a place called Lagos, which is in Nigeria, in West Africa.
Mm-hmm.
Because my father had been in the Royal Marines and he didn't want to be a career soldier, so he left and he got a job with, but he was an Englishman.
Yes.
Actually, he came out here. He was the ADC to the Governor of Victoria, who was, I think in those days, Sir Dallas Brooks.
Right.
And he he left the Royal Marines and he didn't want to be, so he got a job with BP and was posted to Nigeria. That's why my parents happened to be there.
Right. And did they meet there?
No, they met at Government House in Victoria, in Melbourne.
Oh, a nice place to meet.
Some party or something, I don't know.
Now, your grandfather, Cecil Nugent, was a rear admiral, and that's how you got your very impressive middle name, Nugent.
Yes, so he was a Sir Cecil, actually. So Cecil Nugent, what a name, God.
Sir,
and
very
I
nice.
Never met him, to be honest. He was my father's father, and yes, he was an admiral, and he was King George V's ADC, I think. So, it was that sort of, on that side, it was that kind of background.
And so you were born there in Lagos, Nigeria.
Yep.
How old were you when you moved into Mount Eliza?
I think I was about three, maybe four. And my brother was born in Nigeria as well. So the two of us were born.
You and David, huh?
Yeah, David was born there as well. But when we came back here, he was very young. He's probably one or something. So I was probably three. So I'm 2 years old.
Yeah. Right.
And I think we lived in North Baldwin for a little bit. That was my parents got established. And then they bought a place down in, because Mount Eliza was a good hour and a bit.
Would have been farmland.
Yeah, it was.
Farmland and probably a dirt, dirt road.
Yeah, it was dirt roads. And Mount Eliza now, I mean, anyone goes there. But it was just one general store and dirt roads. And they bought a small sort of house. It was someone's holiday house. And
right.
I think there are probably, three other houses in the street.
Wow.
And they moved there and we just grew up there.
Now, did you and David get on?
Yeah, we were, we're brothers, so we got on really well. We're very good friends now. We're really good. We've always been good friends. So, he's part, we're sort of pretty close socially. I see him quite a bit, he and his wife, Karina. And, you're brothers. So you have great times and you have, brotherly fights. You just have, it was a normal brotherly kind of relationship, I think.
I suppose your role, you and David's role, would be to look after your young sister, Elizabeth, growing up.
Yeah, I think possibly. I mean, because I'm 6 years older than my sister, so, I still have a great relationship with her. I always had a great relationship with her. And, but I think by the time in those, when you're that age, when I left home, she was 11.
Right.
So, you know, and then so she spent sort of 5 or 6 years at home where there was no me, and then 2 years after that, probably no David.
Mm.
We just left home. As soon as we finished school, we were out.
Right, so you went to Peninsula High School?
Peninsula Grammar, or they'd hate you.
Oh, mate, shoot me now. Shoot me now.
God, Gavin, what are you saying?
Peninsula Grammar. I do apologise.
No, that's right. Then I went to Monash University.
Monash?
And I did. Yeah. I think I went start off doing law, then law arts, then arts, then dropped out. And then I got accepted into the Victorian College of Arts, into the drama program in 77. So I did, and that was a 3-year course, but I only did 2 years and 1 week of the third year, and then I dropped out of that.
Did you get a lot out of that course?
No, I did. Well, at the time I did, I think, when I think about it now, if I ever do, I wish I'd had this. They were finding their feet. It was only the second year that they'd ever had a drama program.
Right. Oh.
And I think they were finding their feet. And it was still, there was a bit of a hangover from the kind of north of the river, Carlton in Melbourne, Carlton suburb, the Fram Factory. They were very big, this sort of alternative theatre kind of thing. And I went there thinking, oh, great, you know, drama school. And they were pretty selective in who you had to go and audition and do callbacks. And they took 25 people a year.
Okay.
Like, sort of like NIDA. It was like the NIDA in Melbourne.
Yeah,
kind of.
Yeah.
But NIDA were training actors to go and get jobs as actors, where they were, when I was there, I know it's different now, but when I was there, it was more this alternative theatre thinking, trying to change theatre and society by changing, you know, railing against the establishment.
Okay.
And things like the MTC in those days were regarded as the enemy and things like that. Now, when I was there going, can't we just work on scripts and learn how to be an actor and going out and get jobs as an actor? So anyway, I did that for 2 years and then 1 week of third year, then I left. But mainly, I didn't leave because I was necessarily because of that, but because it was that combined with the fact that Australian Crawl had sort of started. It was very, very early days. But we were starting to do more and more shows.
That was Spiff Rauch.
Spiff Rauch, yes. We had Spiff Rauch.
Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives since 1934. Visit tobinbrothers.com.au.
Hi there, this is James Rain, and you're listening to Gavin Wood's podcast.
Now, I looked up the meaning of spiff, and it's kind of stylish, and Rauch is kind of a pleated lace. So you're getting into style and the look of things at a very young age, which is great, you know, to form a new band and have a very stylish name like that.
Yeah, I think so. Spiff Rauch, the one I was in, was the second version of Spiff Rauch. There was an earlier version that I wasn't in.
Right.
And I was told, because I used to go, I like the name, but where'd the name come from? And I was told by the guys who were in the earlier version, a couple of the guys in the one I was in were in the earlier version.
Right.
And it was saying, being drunk, saying Cliff Richard three times quickly. It comes out of Spiff Rauch. Apparently. So that's apparently the name.
Oh, I love that. And I'm sure Sir Cliff would love it too.
Sir Cliff probably would,
yes,
I guess.
Yeah. Well, that was kind of the start of Australian Crawl, wasn't it? Because then you had Clutch Cargo.
Yeah, Clutch Cargo for one show.
Is that right?
The very first show we ever did, and we just had to – we didn't have a name.
Right.
And it was one of those things where they needed a name to put on the poster, and we thought, oh, God. And I think we used to watch – or we didn't watch it, but it was on. It used to be on. It was sort of – I don't know, you sort of laugh about it because it was such a ridiculous cartoon, the Clutch Cargo cartoon, because it was just still pictures.
Okay.
And they had these mouths, but they filmed moving mouths.
Oh.
But they just put the moving mouths on still pictures. And that was Clutch Cargo. So I think we just went, I think someone would have just said, oh, call it Clutch Cargo.
Yeah.
And then we'll fix it
okay.
later.
And of course, in 78, Australian Crawl formed,
yep.
and did you name it after the swimming stroke?
Yes, we did. Three of us at the beginning, and latterly after Guy joined, four of us used to swim. We'd all swum competitively in the same different age groups, or Brad and I in the same age group, but Guy was 2 years ahead of us, and Bill was 4 years ahead of us, or 5 years ahead. Anyway, we're all in the same swimming squad when we're at school and in our teenage years, and we're all coached by the same Guy, who was a fabulous swimming coach and a very funny man. So just, like, I don't know, we're just thinking, well, it's, and it looked different in the gig guide then, because in those days, all the bands were called the Somethings.
Yeah.
Because at the beginning of sort of little bit post-punk or punky sort of
sure.
Australian, Melbourne's version.
Mm.
And it was all the this and the that. And so we thought, well, we want something that sticks out, so we don't call ourselves the Somethings. So I don't know. Like every band, when you think of a name, you have 25 other, you know, some serious and some just ridiculous.
Yeah. So Australian Crawl in its early days How did you, you would have done lots of gigs, of course. How did you get the man with the big cigar and the record company saying, hey, we want to offer you a deal?
Well, what we used to do is when we all grew up, we all lived on the Mornington Peninsula, and we used to run, because we did this, one thing we did learn from Spiff Rouse that we used in Australian Crawl was you have these sort of community halls dotted around the Mornington Peninsula.
Sure.
The Tybe Community Hall and the Baxter Community Hall and the Merricks, you know, and you can rent, in those days, you could rent them for fairly cheaply. And you could go to the police station, you could buy, and I've probably got the figure wrong, but you could buy a liquor license for $25, which meant you couldn't sell booze, but people could come, see the band, and they could drink on the premises.
Okay.
And we had to clean up. So we'd run these gigs, and we'd hire the hall, we'd get them going by the license, and then we'd just put posters up around the place. And because, you know, word spreads fairly quickly around here, well, down on the peninsula, we'd get these incredible crowds. And we kept doing that. So we'd run our own gigs. And it was a way of making a little bit of money to put back into the band. And there was an agency in Melbourne, in the city, called Nucleus. And there was a girl there called Sandra Robertson.
Great girl.
And so she'd heard about this band on the peninsula that was pulling crowds. And she, I don't know how she got my, in those days, no mobiles or anything. She rang me and spoke to me and out of the blue and said, look, we've heard about you. Would you guys be interested in having us as an agency? We'll get you gigs in Melbourne. And we went, oh, great. So that was the beginning of that. And then once Sandra got involved and therefore the agency, we started to get a lot, you know, over the weeks and months, we started to get more and more gigs in Melbourne. So that's where that really started. And then there started to be, and we started to get residencies at places like Martini's in Carlton. There's a pub down in Geelong we did every Thursday night for months. Ian Lovell ran.
Yeah, I remember Ian,
Ian Lovell, dear Ian. And,
he was connected with Goanna, wasn't he, Ian Lovell? Yeah.
Yeah, he basically discovered Goanna and he managed the site. And then, so we just built it that way. And you'd play gigs and there'd be 50 people. And then the next week there might be 75. It was small numbers, but you could actually see the crowds building. And I remember, this is related to Count, this will relate to Countdown, is that there's one time we were playing Martini's after we'd been there for a few months, and there's a buzz because, oh, Molly's coming down to see the band.
Fabulous. That'll make you really, really nervous.
Oh, wow. Probably a bit nervous, but just in terms of, wow, this could be like if he likes us, then possibly, you know, something might come out of that. I remember he came down. I think Michael Ginniski came down as well. Dear Michael came down. And I think the word came back to us. Oh, what do they think? Oh, they think maybe probably a year away.
Oh, okay.
Oh, great. But anyways, but it was only 6 months or something later that, you know, because we played so much that there started to be a bit of interest. And then I think David Briggs, who was in Little River Band, there was a little bit of a buzz. And I think, you know, once one record company sort of gets half interested, then the others think, oh, we're missing out on something. And then David expressed an interest in producing a single for us. And I think we got a deal at EMI. I can't remember the chronology of everything. Anyway, we did some demos with David Briggs and through that did one single, Beautiful People. And then that went okay and then that led to the EMI going, well, now we'll let you make an album.
Well, back then, you've got to remember, there was A&R guys everywhere at every pub. The record companies, they were all trying to eat each other to get the next biggest thing. So your timing couldn't have been better.
I think so. Not that we knew it, but, you know, it was that period in Australian music culture where radio, I think it was all a perfect kind of, not a perfect, it was a perfect...
Radio and Countdown.
Yeah, the timing. Yeah. So Countdown was on, obviously, as you know better than anybody. Countdown was on, so that was a great... Because I remember, you know, we used to watch Countdown and think, oh, Countdown, but we'd all watch it. And, you know, if you got on Countdown, because the ABC, as you know, would get to everywhere in Australia. So it was a perfect time. There was Countdown and then Australian radio...
Yes.
The beginning of FM, so it was going AM, then into FM. So we start on AM, but radio there you'd have DJs, for instance, Hans and Barry Bissell, were on. Yeah, and Hans on XY, I think, and they had the morning show. And I think they were the first guys that played Australian Crawl because they liked it, and they could. In those days, you could play something if you had a radio show and you were a DJ. You could play something you like because you go, "I like this, I'm going to play it." And it started to get some interest through that, which can't really happen anymore. Because it's all centrally programmed and blah, blah, blah. So it was just this perfect kind of marriage of everything sort of happening at the same time, not that we knew it.
Well, it's good to have you know, the band going, the record deal, and all of that. Now, what happened with your arms when you first appeared on Countdown? That would have been a bit of bad timing. What were you doing?
I was coming back from Sydney, and I think I'd been to Sydney. What was I in Sydney for? I think it was to go and see the record company. I think, I don't know why it was just me, but anyway. And I was coming back from Sydney, and I was supposed to go to band practice, like the band, to rehearsal. I was crossing Swanston Street in the city, and I wasn't looking, and I got hit by a car.
Oh, you poor thing.
Yeah.
So you've got the plaster on both arms, and then the Countdown unit says, oh, can you be on the show on Friday?
Well, it was, I think it was probably because we would have known about, we're going on Countdown, and because they're, obviously you didn't get on Countdown until there was some sort of real interest in the band.
Mm.
And then the Countdown just really kicked it into the national, you know, you became known nationally.
Yeah.
And so it was sort of, it was, can you believe it? Broken both my arms and we got to go on Countdown, first time. And I remember we all used to go, if nothing happens, at least we'll be known as the band with that singer that had both his arms in plaster.
Yeah.
And it was probably a gimmick.
Yeah, what a story. What a story.
Yeah.
From Countdown, of course, you know, you could do Countdown on the Sunday night and then sell out in Wagga Wagga on a Tuesday night.
That's correct. And you would. You'd probably, Monday was often the only night off that you had. And you, and we and many, many other bands, you know, as you know, at that time, it was such a fertile time because you could play six nights a week for 10, 11 months of the year all over Australia.
How did your voice hold up?
Well, because you're young and you know, fine. You just, because you're working all the time and it's a young,
it's a young
instrument. You can go all the time, and we weren't looking after ourselves
no.
at all. We'd go and do gigs and then go out. I think get up, you know, with 3 hours sleep and get in the car and go somewhere else and drive for 5 hours and do another gig.
Now, Australian Crawl would have played every stage in Australia, I'd imagine. You wouldn't have left one stage empty. In that fertile period, and with that, and with Countdown and all songs like Boys Light Up, Beautiful People, Downhearted, Reckless, Errol, Oh No, Not You Again, Things Don't Seem, songs that have lasted 40 years, you've sold over, you know, a million albums. It's been an incredible ride in your Australian Crawl period.
Yeah, it was, you know, when I look at it now, I think it was. I mean, it was. But again, because I suppose, you know, we had songs, and I think there was something about them. I mean, we didn't know it at the time, obviously. You don't know it. And I think it was...
But, James, they were good songs. They were great songs.
Well, thanks.
You would have seen the crowd light up.
Sorry
to say that, but you would have seen the crowd respond to those songs.
Oh, yeah, they used to go crazy. And I think, again, Gavin, it's one of those, it was a marriage of all these different factors that you couldn't really plan. Radio was right. Countdown was there. You could the live venue scene, you know, there weren't any other alternatives for the sort of rock music entertainment dollar. So there was no internet. There was no there were four channels, you know, and there was only one rock show. There was Donny Sutherland's show on Saturday mornings, but, you know, that was sort of it. And, we went on Don, you know, the things like Don Land's show. But it was just this perfect marriage. And everybody, if you came to their town on the week, or any night of the week, that's why you could play any night of the week. They wanted to get out. The young people wanted to get out, and their local pub, they probably have two or three pubs in town, that most places would have at least one pub that had bands. So you could play any town in Australia, and everybody did. And that's why it was so good. And they weren't things like, I shouldn't say this, but now they have, you know, you have crowd capacities. They say a crowd capacity is in some places 1,200 people, so they'll only put 1,200 people in there. Now, I've played some places where it's, crowd capacity, 1,000 people. So they put 1,000 people. And I say, I remember playing this in 1983, and we had 3,500 people. And it was so crowded. It was insane. You know, nowadays you wouldn't be allowed to do it with OH&S.
Yeah, well, all the suburban pubs, like, you know, the Matthew Flinders, the Donny Inn, you know, all that, you know, the Village Green, you know, they had a capacity of, you know, 700 or something. They'd put 1,600 in there, crammed in.
Easily. And people would be literally hanging from the roof, and there'd be sweat everywhere, and there'd always be a brawl. You'd almost think it's not success, not a good night, and there's been a brawl. You're not getting them wound up.
In 1981, Australian Crawl voted most popular band in the Countdown Awards, and then in 1980 and 81, you, James Rain, were voted the most popular male performer. And then the brand broke up in 86. So what a ride, man.
Yeah, it was pretty quick, but you got a lot done and, you know, you got on with it.
Let's get on to your solo career, mate.
Okay, sure.
87, James Rain with Hammerhead and my favourite song of all time. Oh, well, apart from Hoochie Goochie Ferrucci Mama, The Fall of Rome. I adore that song.
Oh, thank you. Thanks very much.
If that was released, you know, all around the world, it would have gone to number one. It was just, it was something magical. I don't know whether you knew it because you had so many songs, but The Fall of Rome to me had something really, really special in it.
Oh, thank you. Well, I quite liked it. I mean, I wrote it for a film, but, and it didn't get used in the film, but, yeah, thanks. I like it too. I still like playing it. It's just got, it's got a, I don't know. I always thought it was a bit, there was no real chorus, but I'd quite like that.
Yeah, but it was way ahead of its time.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks very much. And so it was amazing to some of the people that were playing on it. I mean, not now. I mean, now it wouldn't mean anything to anybody. But back then it was some incredible guitar players did guest solos on it.
How do you write a song, James?
If I knew that, I would bottle it and I would sell it. I don't know. It comes in many different ways. And, you know, it's just, the only thing I know is usually the ones that work, the ones that have a genuine little nugget or flash of some sort of inspiration. You go, what's that? And I don't know where it comes from. I think often you try and create your own luck in a way. You sort of, if you do it a lot or you just put your head down with it a lot and you know, I'm always tinkering with something on the guitar or the piano. Mm-hmm. And if you keep doing that, you know, something might happen at some stage. And it's weird, really weird. Sometimes you can try for months and nothing will happen. And then in a day, you'll come up with two things, go, oh, these are actually feel like they're probably good things.
Yeah. Now, do you do the John Lennon thing and have a notepad by your bed?
No, I don't. Well, I use my phone or use a computer, but if I think of something, I always write it down. If I think something's worth writing down, I'll write it down for sure. Now because I'm hopeless with technology, but if I think of something musically, I'm just strumming a few chords and start singing some noises, I'll record that on my phone. I used not to do that. I used to sing it 100 times so I'd remember it. And I figure if it wasn't any good, I won't remember it.
Ah, okay. Now, I spoke to John Paul Young on a previous podcast, and he told me about Vander and Young and what they did. They had the song title book.
Right.
And they just had a book of song like Lovers in the Air,
yep.
I Hate the Music, and all these little phrases that they've written down in a book. So when they've got a riff, and then they've got the singer that's going to sing the song, and then all of a sudden they marry it together, and they go, oh, what are we going to, how, you know, what's the hook? And then they go through the book,
yep.
And one jumps out, and there it is.
Well, I think that's a very good thing, and I mean, I do that as well. I go to my little list of you know, I've got lots of titles, I've got lots of little couplets, like two lines. Mm. That don't, you know, that sound good together, but they don't mean anything. They're out of context. But you're exactly right. I'll be playing something and I'll start singing. Often I'll sing noises, sing phonetic sounds,
right.
And they start to sound like a word. But then I'll go to my list and just go, oh yeah, hang on, that could fit. Oh, like if I move that word, that could fit really nicely there. Mm. So I think the process is, you know, everyone has a different process. But
there's a video on YouTube with the Bee Gees, the three of them. Just sitting around on keyboards doing a falsetto, you know, la 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 la, trying to get a melody with the three of them, and then they get the melody, and then they infiltrate some words in there, and then they build the song like that. It's like building a brick fence.
It is. It really is, and it's a process. And I think you have to. I used to say it's one of those things where you have to worry it into submission. So you have to sit there, and there's always that thing of. Yeah, the initial inspiration, whatever it is, whether it's musical or a lyric, sometimes you have a title, as you're saying, like Vander and Young, you might have a title. You go, yeah. I love that title. I've got to find something musical. I've got to get that title. I want to get that title into something. So you start messing around. And, you know, people write songs. You've always got four or five or six or ten bits, musical bits, just mm-hmm. laying around. And sometimes you go, oh, you know, that thing I had it like a year and a half ago. Quite like those three chords. This title, that might fit in there. So you always think about it.
Yeah.
And you just got, and then you, once you have the initial burst, then it's the matter of doing the homework. Then you've just got to sit yourself down and look at the blank piece of paper and go, right, let's make this work.
So 1989, you released another album, Hard Rain. Some great songs on that. And then in 1991, Electric Digger Dandy. Now, you released that in America, and the title of that album was Any Day Above Ground.
In America it was, yes. Here it was Electric Digger Dandy, yeah.
Yeah, did you go over and follow up that release and then continue on to Europe?
Well, I spent a lot of time in America because I was right. And the first three solo albums, I was managed by Roger Davies, and Roger was based out of Los Angeles, so I went and lived
Santa
there.
Monica.
I actually lived in Roger. It was out in Sherman Oaks, but I was living in London because I was, you know, I didn't have an American thing, so I'd go back to London and then come back to LA. And that, in fact, those first two records were actually, I was signed directly to Capitol in America.
Right.
And they actually thought the first record, the executives at Capitol were sort of, I spent a week basically being taken out to lunch before they released that first album and saying, we're really confident this record's going to do something. And I thought, really? And I allowed myself for a second to think, this could happen. And then it just didn't.
That's America.
That's America, isn't it?
Yeah.
They blow the hot air and then you go, I'm resisting. No, I think this is BS. But
I know. So after Electric Digger Dandy, you did some collaborations with James Blundell and then Daryl Braithwaite and Simon Hussey.
Yep.
Company of Strangers.
Yep.
So you started to expand your horizons a little bit and then you got into the US, recorded The Whiff of Bedlam. So how did that album go?
The album, it did okay here. That was a period when radio, and I'm not blaming radio, but it's when the radio, you know, sort of music business landscape started to kind of change. It was slowly changing and being a bit more corporatized, as, you know better than anybody, radio was, the record companies were changing. There were, you know, mm-hmm. a new executive kind of class moved into the record companies. And
the accountants moved in.
Correct.
There you go.
Well, the guy that's the marketing manager of McDonald's probably has started to have more to say about what was played on the radio than, you know, the music.
Exactly. And they got rid of all their A&R guys as well. So that ground area where they were sourcing the bands and the pubs and everything like that, that all stopped.
That's right. And I think the whole landscape, I think right across the board in business, I think the whole landscape changed. It started to be more corporatized. And again, I spent a couple of years kind of bitching and moaning about it. And then I realized, well, you're not going to achieve anything by doing that. And I just went, you know, I understand what's happening. I understand why it's happening. Unfortunately, it's going to have some odd repercussions in the business as we know it, but you've got to move, you've got to go with the flow. So I think it was just one of those things where, and that's when I really started to notice, I could still go and, you know, do promotion stuff at radio, but they'd sort of go, you'd go in and sort of promote your new record, but they'd say, love it, James, we're going to play Boys Light Up right now. And you go, oh, okay, love it, but, you know, guys.
Yeah, familiarity. So, yeah. Well, see, you got to remember too, James, back in the XY days when I was there, you know, we'd only pick up five new singles a week, you know, so, and now they don't do that anymore. You know, the Australian music quota has got to go to 20%, and it's got to be watched. At the moment, they get away with it.
Well, I think you go to 50%. I've been so for years. I mean, you look at the country to do that on Ireland, and they have.
Yeah.
But anyway, look, it's one of those things we can bitch and moan, and it's a shame, but it's how it is. And, you know, and that went on for years and still does. I mean, it's just become a completely different thing again. So, and I mean, you would have seen it too. I mean, I've now seen, I don't know how many different executive levels of changes. I mean, we're up to the 30th lot I've seen, you know, and you go in there now, and they're all lovely and I love them, and I'm completely at home with them now. I go in there and just enjoy myself and have fun with the experience of being on the radio and have a laugh, and they go, bring your guitar, James, play records.
There's only the crew from the 80s that can actually take a guitar in there and sing, you know, and do an acoustic gig. You know, the current crew, the ones that work off their computers and everything like that, they can't do it. So,
some of them can. I've seen some of them. Some of them are great. I'm not going to do anything. I think some of them, look, like every, genre, every generation of music, musicians, singers, you know, songwriters, you've got 10, 20% who are genuinely
good musicians.
almost inspirationally good, and they have a genuine talent, and then you've got the rest of them are kind of these, you know, people. And that's always been the case. Yeah. It's always been the case.
Well, let's get to 2004. You landed, I think you might have come home again, landed at Liberation Records.
Landed at Liberation, yes, I did. Yep, because I had a record on Roadshow Records. It was one of the best records I reckon I've ever made, but anyway. And that was kind of came and went. But and that's funny too, because I was on Roadshow Records, and Roadshow at that stage I owned both radio networks that existed then. And I remember I couldn't get added to the radio. I was on Roadshow, and I remember writing a letter to the boss of Roadshow. Forget his name, or the brothers, the actual head of Roadshow, the whole company, saying, please explain to me the commercial sense of spending money on an act like me and signing me and then not making a company policy that you whack me on your radio stations. And I never got a reply.
Was that Graham Burke?
Is it the Burke brothers?
Yeah, Burke brothers.
We're one of them.
Tobin Brothers Funerals, a family-owned business since 1934. Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Hi there, this is James Rain, and you're listening to Gavin Wood's podcast.
Hey, listen, congratulations. I haven't had a chance because I've been away, but congratulations on your 2014 Australia Day honours.
Oh, thank
the
you.
The Order of Australia, OAM. Mate, that must have made the family feel proud because, you know, when you say to your mum and dad, I'm going to be a muso, they go, uh-oh. But then when you come home with an OAM, you've made it.
Yes, well, I remember in those days leaving university to be in a band was not looked on proud, you know, they went, what?
Yeah, not cool.
Now they encourage you from primary school. But no, I remember ringing my mother because you're not allowed to tell anyone because they tell you a couple of months before they announce it. And I said, can I ring my mum? I said, you can tell your mum. So I rang my mum and she said to me, she said, why would they give you one of those?
Oh, dear. Don't you love mums?
Okay, well, I didn't know why they gave it to me, but anyway, they did.
Well, they did because of all the work and all the charity work you do and all of that, you know, all the stuff that is unseen.
That's, you do it quietly. You get on with it.
And people see that, you know, and the people are impressed by that. Now, I want to talk about seeing you on stage in front of 15,000 people at the Countdown Arena Spectacular, the first one. We're all very nervous, but, man, you got up there and all those people was silent when you were on. You had such a command on the stage, you know, doing Reckless and those great songs of yours. It must have been a great feeling for you.
Yeah, it was great. And that was actually, you're right, that was a kind of, not an experiment, but it was certainly one of those things everybody, I think, involved at the start was going, this could really work, or is it, you know, and it really did. And everyone on the show and everyone behind the scenes were great.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody got on really well. In fact, I remember having a laugh with James Freud, and you know, when we were all younger in our respective bands, and we'd all, you know, you get to know these people because you know you see them around, and you can be quite friendly with a lot of them, but behind their back, you know, we're all going, the models, who they think they are, and they'd be saying the same thing about us. But James and I were having a laugh because before we'd go on, we'd all say to each other, "Yeah, have a great show. Yeah, good luck, good on you." We were laughing, going, this is crazy. And they're all, you know, being nice to each other. Was, you know, when we were younger, we were going, yeah, hate them, yeah.
Yeah.
So that was what that did, that Countdown thing engendered that. It was just a very nice spirit. And I remember Daryl hired a car. And I remember we thought we won't go on the bus today because Daryl said, why don't you and me and Daryl and Steve Cummings, we all just drove. I remember we drove from Newcastle to Sydney because we weren't going to go on the bus because Daryl hired a car.
Oh, you lucky things. I was on the bus.
All the guys had been drinking till about an hour before they got on the bus.
Yeah.
That's why I went, we might just avoid the bus today.
Yeah, well, that would have been a better mode of transport and a lot more fun.
Yeah, so we had a little scenic tour. I had to sit in the back because I was the junior.
Oh.
Daryl drove and Stephen sat in the passenger seat and they were like a couple of old deers in the front clucking away there. And listen to you guys, listen to you.
Well, mate, that the Countdown Arena show must have given you the confidence to keep going with the solo career and ramp it up and given you the confidence to know, hey, I've got this solo career, I can take it right to the end.
Yeah, and I'm lucky that, again, we kept talking about it, but it was that confluence of events where everything was in the right spot, that I can now play I can do an hour and a half show of songs that pretty much everyone's going to know pretty much all the songs. So I can tour that. Mm-hmm. We throw in the odd new one now and then, you know, which is just for my sake because I like to do it. But we, and it's great, and I really enjoy, I've come back around to really enjoying playing nearly, you know, pretty much all those songs. You know, Hoochie Goochie, I don't know about, because I've never liked that song, but anyway. But,
you've never liked it? You've never liked it?
It's awful. But I still play it.
Oh,
I still play it.
My taste must be up the boot.
No,
I love that
no,
song.
No, I'm the one that's, everyone else, whenever we play it, people go nuts.
Mm. Yeah.
So it's me. I'm the one that doesn't get it. I'm going, what is this? You know, I wrote it when I was about 17. It's just clunky to me. That's to me.
Oh, no, it's beautiful. It just sends up the elite. I love it. Hey, listen, how did you cope with the 2-year pandemic? How did you get through that?
Oh, like everybody, I think it was sort of fun for the first month or so, and then it was like, well, this is you just had to accept it and do it. And I think the world was learning what this thing was. And how we deal with it. And we know so much more now than we did then. But I think the thing I'm finding really interesting is the world now, post-pandemic, is it feels like it's just, it can't really get itself moving. It's sort of, you know, on right across the board in all sorts of areas. It just feels like there's some weird kind of karmic something weirdness going on in the world, you know?
It's because there's still people in hospital and stuff like that, and you still hear those figures every day, so you're still in the back of your mind going, oh, will I take that mask with me?
Yeah.
You know, it's all that uncertainty. So mate, hopefully by October, November, everybody will be out.
Yes.
And everybody will be at your show, special guest Nick Barker.
Yep.
And I love the poster with the Sandman on the poster.
Thank you very
much. That just was that your idea?
No, I think it was more Scott Crawford's, who manages me, his idea. But you know, he said, and I always go, yeah, that's a great idea. You know, the tongue's in the cheek a bit, but you know, that's good.
That's great. I love it. It sets it up because the name of the tour is the Songs of Beaches Tour. It's a great title.
Well, thanks very much again. That's Scott, because it was going to be Originally, this tour was going to be when the Boys Light Up album turned 40, which is a few years ago now.
Okay.
But I didn't know that Scott realised that. It was, okay, great. And then COVID happened. So Boys Light Up is probably now about 44. So and then there was, you know, Sirocco was going to be 40. And then so we just thought, we'll just call it Songs of Beaches, which is a good title.
Fantastic. And you're going out with Nick Barker October, November. You can see all the tour dates on jamesrain.com.au and also buy your tickets there.
Yes.
And won't that bring back some memories? I mean, you'll be on stage for, what, an hour, 15? That's a long time.
An hour and a half, yeah.
A lot of songs there.
Yep.
Now, you've been doing, you know, the Boys Light Up anniversary tour and also the Red Hot Summer tours. You're loving the open air tours?
I love them. I love these. The outdoor shows where, again, with, you know, several other bands, because it's all care, no responsibility. And I have this theory that I tell everybody else, because we always go on second last. So the last one, we're still doing the run with Hunters and Collectors, and I'm good friends with Mark Semmel.
Uh-huh.
And I said, Mark, you know, the best spot, just to get it going, but you know the best spot is second last, because they've seen five or six rock and roll bands, and they see the second last act, and then they've got to start thinking about, well, I've got to get home. Get the car out of the car park, and there are like 50,000 board, 20, you know, 15,000 people here. And I'm the designated driver. I brought all my friends, and they've been drinking, so I just want to get them out of here. Mm. So, we're second last. So, yeah, they're great. I love those shows.
No one would dare leave your part.
No, they don't dare. They don't move a muscle. They move many muscles, but not the leading ones.
Have you ever thought about writing a book?
It's been suggested to me a few times, but you know, maybe when I'm 95.
Well, mate, you'd have lots and lots of stories. Now, I really thank you for your time.
Thank you.
We have 10 questions without notice. I call them the top 10, if you don't mind.
Yep, sure.
First question, who inspired you to make music?
Oh, man, so many people. I don't know. But first hearing Creedence Clearwater Revival, when I was 11 or something, probably went, whoa, what's that?
Okay. Second question, what have you learnt over your musical journey?
I've learnt that I don't know much and I have much more to learn.
Oh, that's brilliant. Question 3, what was the effect of Countdown on your career? I think I know the answer to this one.
Hugely significant, because it took us to the whole country.
If you could open up a show for any artist, who would it be?
I hate being support.
Yeah, I know.
Annoying. It's really frustrating.
No, that's your answer. Okay, cool. That's okay. Next question. Name three dinner guests, dead or alive.
Okay, this question. Everyone goes for John F. Kennedy, Jesus Christ, and Gandhi. I'd go for three good friends, because I think you put those three alphas together, they'd all cancel each other out and everyone would be silent.
Oh.
You know, that people always go, what's your one wish? To solve world hunger.
Yeah. I gotcha. That's good. What's your favourite song to perform?
There's a song of our mine called Water, Water I quite like. I like doing Own On It You Again. I like doing Fall of Rome.
Uh-huh. Good. What's the most trouble you've ever gotten into, apart from breaking your arms and most getting trouble. Hit by a car?
Listen, for the sake of, be careful how I answer this one. I don't know. I can't think of a few things I can think of. I don't know. I can't think, Gavin, the most trouble I've ever got into.
Well, obviously you didn't get into much trouble, that's good.
I've been a good lad all this time.
Yes, let's move on. If you could change anything about the music industry, what would you do?
That's a huge question. I would get more music people involved on an executive level.
Amen to that. What's the best show that you have ever done?
Probably some obscure show somewhere obscure on a Wednesday night when you weren't even thinking about it. And you came off stage going, wow, everything fell into place.
Yeah, that's a good feeling, huh?
Yeah, oh, it's fantastic. You just know, that's why we do it. That's why we do it.
Final question. What have you learnt and what would you pass on to a young, hopeful James Rain?
Always keep your mind open. Do not close your mind to anything. Keep it open. Keep reading. Keep learning. Keep it open.
James, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. I thank you so much for your time. And don't miss James Rain in concert October, November. Go to jamesrain.com.au where you can see the tour dates and buy the tickets. James, love you, mate. Thanks for your time.
Thank you very much, Gavin. Good on you.
Gavin Wood's podcast was thanks to Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.